telephonically for access by the public. Terry Lehane, Rhode Island Housing's Director of IT, will provide information on this meeting.
Good morning. This is Terry Lehane, Director of IT at Rhode Island Housing. This meeting will be recorded and available for review on the Rhode Island Housing website within 3 to 5 business days after the meeting. To prevent any feedback or background noise, your telephones will be muted. If during the meeting anyone is having technical difficulties with audio or accessing the call, they should call 401-429-1427.
Thank you, Terry. Good morning. This is Corinne Myers, General Counsel. Members of the public can visit the RI Housing website to view today's agenda and documents and information on each of the actions being taken. If the teleconference portion of the meeting is interrupted, we will stop the meeting and attempt to restore the audio. Chair of our board, Deborah Goddard, will preside at this morning's meeting. Commissioners, staff, and guests, please do state your name prior to speaking each and every time for the benefit of those listening in by teleconference. And with that, I'll turn it over to the chair to call the meeting to order. Thank you.
Good morning. Meeting to order, and Carol, would you do roll call? Commissioner McAllister?
Here.
Commissioner Orr?
Here.
Commissioner Goddard?
Here.
Commissioner Tiosa?
Here.
Here. Thank you. First item of business is the approval of the minutes of the board meeting held on January 22nd, 2026. Do I have a motion?
Motion by James Tiosa.
Second by Steve.
Any corrections or questions, concerns? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
That was unanimous acceptance of the minutes. I just thought I would speak to a little bit of what's going on over at the housing office because it's complimentary. So we are coming close to announcing awards on infrastructure, which will support some projects coming through our joint pipeline. We have two buckets of money. One is for the hard costs infrastructure. The bond set aside $4 million. We add another $4 million. We also, there's $1 million for municipal technical assistance, which is not a capital eligible item, but we've turned it into, thanks to actually Randy Rossi, I believe, A&E services for capital infrastructure. That was just $1 million there. So those two things will be coming out soon. And then you'll see they're clearly mentioned, the pipeline is moving through Rhode Island Housing. We've also announced some months ago the home repair program, and within days, we paused taking applications. Really, just hundreds and hundreds of applications. So they're sorting through that now, but clearly a high demand for that program. Probably heard that we issued RFP for half of the home ownership money last week. The goal is to get units priced under 400K. Supporting them with up to 100K per unit or $4 million a project. It's a tough challenge given our costs. We are really highly promoting factory-built housing. We had sent letters to 18 to 24 firms asking for pricing information, site costs, blah, 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 and drawings. And so that is now, Sarah Kelsey's put that into an accessible format. It's on our website. So go see it, but we're really, I think that has to be a key part of the solution to the pricing. These are entry-level homes, 1,200, 1,400 square feet. Really the challenge there is we don't have zoning in many places that fits the small entry-level, but 1,200 on an acre doesn't really make sense. So that's a challenge, one that I keep reminding communities of. Because it is the first time out in this specific realm, we only put half the money out. Some folks might be ready, others might, this might gin up their thinking, so we wanted to give another round later in the spring. Monitoring agents, some of you know, there's what I call the wild, wild west out there, monitoring agents, Wilmot Law, looking at both rental and homeownership, who's qualified, how are they being underwritten, what's going on, resale, so on and so forth. We were charged last year with certifying monitoring agents, which we have done. We've also created a monitoring agent guidebook to address some of what we really see as some abuses, building and selling to your family members, home buyers starting underwater from day one, the way they're being underwritten. So we thought we really had a responsibility for those certifying monitoring agents to make sure they're acting under guidelines requirements that have a consumer protection aspect, as well as, you know, just upholding the dunes of Lomond law. So that's out there. It'll always be a work in progress. There's always some instance that brings up a new question. We'll keep going with that. That's it, Mike, Tom, your shot. And then, as you might know, we have our bond hearing Tuesday night. As much as you want, and you get into a debate about how much of a labor market you're going to rob from the state to support your housing goals, you just go, I just didn't get my speech. But, you know, that's done for now. We head to the Senate on the bond bill. One thing we are trying to emphasize is it's very generic, except for homeownership. Let's keep it generic. We like to be, it'll be responsive. But we also tried some new things this year. Set-asides, let's not whipsaw the development community. Let's give those set-asides, small-scale development and then support housing. Let's give them some time to mature. And for instance, we moved money into infrastructure. That wasn't required. We created a home repair program. That wasn't called up. So it's good. I think it's good for us to have collectively have some ability to respond to what we're hearing, what's going on. So we're trying to keep that flexibility. And of course, we never know what's going to happen in Washington. We made it through this budget mostly, for the most part, level funded, which means, you know, our ability to use the funds shrinks and shrinks and shrinks in terms of units because it's not keeping up with inflation or anything else. So we want to be able to respond to Washington as well. So that's what's going on our side of the collective partnership.
Okay. We've got a few, two presentations for you today on my ET report. I'm just going to highlight two items. First, Melanie and the development group is hard at work underwriting over 40 applications for funding. As always, we're oversubscribed, and we'll just have to prioritize those that are ready to go. Those are most cost effective, and so they're working on that. And we had the opportunity to join Joe Golic and about 16 speakers at No Race in Woonsocket, and the governor was there, and Senator Green, Senator Whitehouse. Joe began this journey in 2014, finally has completed the project, and it looks fantastic, and there's going to be 70 very happy households in Woonsocket that are going to have affordable homes.
So. I saw the picture. I thought that was all the people moving in.
Yeah. It had to be 75 people, but yeah, it's like 17 different speakers.
We managed 70 people a lot more quickly than most managed six.
Yes. And I have to acknowledge Melina Lodge. She was the last speaker, and she brought with her an excerpt of the letter that she received from an elderly couple that lost their home. And their challenge in finding something affordable that they could, it was very, very moving and very appropriate for them. So we have a video of our FSS graduation event, and then Leslie and Peter are going to move right into their presentation on ownership lending and home servicing. So Leslie, are you in control of this? Great.
Welcome, graduates, family, friends, and colleagues, to the Family Self-Sufficiency Graduation Ceremony. Tonight, we celebrate you, graduates.
And I found out through an email, and I was like, what is this? Can't be true. I chatted, and she was like, no, Maggie, this, you set these goals. You obtain the goals, you get this. And I was like, all right, I'm going to give it a whirl.
It feels like a great accomplishment that I did so my children can see how hard I work towards my goals going back to school.
The FSS program is one of the most effective tools offered to help families achieve lasting economic stability.
This program gave me more than financial tools. It gave me confidence, knowledge, and a clear path forward.
Today isn't just a ceremony. It's a testament to resilience, determination, and the power of partnership. We didn't just complete a program, we built a future.
I want to acknowledge and thank the FFS team for your care and dedication in the administration of the program and your love for the participants within it.
Martha said, keep going, like you can do this, I know you can. And I kept going and here I am today. So today I step forward, empowered, prepared and proud, knowing that my family's future is stronger because I chose this.
partnership with Proctus, so they were very robust. And now, on to Leslie.
Great, thanks, Carol. So Leslie is going to be talking about loan performance and our portfolio and so forth. And we thought it made sense to receive some information from home ownership on the characteristics of the loan and who our borrowers are. So this information is for 2025, whereas some of the information that you'll see from Leslie has more of a historical bent. But if you take a look at the first slide, around 43% of our borrowers are female head of household, around 50% minority, and average age of 38. So the first two bullets, the female head of household and minority, have stayed rather consistent over the last 10 years or so. The average age has also stayed consistent. But the interesting point here is that nationally, the average age for many, many years was 33. We saw that everywhere. It's very consistent. Now it's 38, but our 38 has stayed stayed put at 38, even with all the challenges. So I thought that was an interesting point to bring forth, how we're different than the national trend there. When we look at our property types, of course, in my area, multifamily is defined as 2 to 4 units. Anything 5 and more is considered, single family is 2 to 4 units. Anything over 4 is considered multifamily. So single family, 60% of our originations. Condominium, 80%. Interesting point there is that we have a lot of borrowers who really wanted to purchase single family homes, but had to go condo for obvious income reasons and debt to income ratios and price levels. So that condo number has grown a bit. And on the multifamily side, we continue to see borrowers who want to be landlords, investors, owner-occupied investors, but also multi-generational living. So we've seen that increase over the last few years. Getting down to some of the loan level characteristics, we're happy with that credit score, average credit score of 718. That has grown substantially over the years. For example, in 2021, the average score was 696. And prior to that, we were in the 670s and 680s. So we've gone in just probably 8 short years from mediocre credit score average to average credit score average, and now a good credit score. Happy with that number there. Household income grown substantially, as you could imagine, dramatically since 2021. Again, just about 64,000 in 2021, and now we're at 108,000, just north of that. Debt to income ratio, almost 47%. And again, that includes not only the borrower's PITI, but any other monthly recurring debt, whether it's revolving credit line, term debt, student loans, car loans, so forth. Nationally, I heard on the news the other day that it takes your average homeowner, they need 42% of their gross monthly income to just satisfy their monthly housing expense, PITI. So that 46.5 is fairly consistent with what we're seeing nationally. Obviously, add on some debt to get to that 46.5. And then we operate with loans that are highly leveraged, almost 100% CLTV, as we can see there. We have very strong down payment assistance products, closing cost products, and of course, those play a huge role there. And then the next statistic is not a surprise for anyone. Our average loan is now $415,000, up 46% since 2021. Yes.
Commissioner Carter, I'm going back to multifamily.
Yeah.
So that is something more than 4 units, and it's called?
No, I'm sorry. So multifamily is 2 to 4 units in the home ownership front. And so just about 32% are more than one unit. Looking at our production, and this is consistent with what you'll see with what the overall book of business, we're at about 72% government-insured mortgages. The vast majority are FHA loans. Few VA loans have been very few rural development loans, and around 28% conventional. Right now, the majority are Fannie Mae as opposed to Freddie Mac. Participating lender business has grown substantially since 2013, where we made a conscious effort to really take advantage of the banks, depositories, IMBs, brokers in the state. And we now have about 93% of our business with institutional lenders. And just thought it may be interesting for all of you to look at what our market share is. This is an estimation. The numbers we looked at did not have cash purchases, but we did speak to a few closing agents and get a sense of what they're seeing in terms of cash purchases. This number, of course, also doesn't include jumbo mortgages, all A mortgages, if you will, debt service coverage ratio loans, if you will. So that 16% is a fairly conservative number for what we think we're doing in the state. Who reviews our loans? Who approves our loans? So we have a team on staff of four, very seasoned, direct endorsement, which is the title they receive for FHA underwriters. They each have about, with an average of about 30 years experience. They digest, interpret the findings that they get from the automated underwriting system that Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae produce. Majority of the industry use this technology, and it's the job of the underwriter to make sure that the inputs make sense and to evaluate any gray area that may exist on the application. And of course, the AUS systems are to determine whether the loan will ultimately be saleable to the GSEs and to FHA. We have two overlays. So underwriting guidelines that go above and beyond what the institutional investors or the GSEs want to see. We have a minimum 620 credit score. Nationally, FHA can go below 620, but we have a line at 620. And in order to reduce risk, we don't want to see multiple layers of risk in a transaction. We require for anyone that has a greater than 50 debt to income ratio to have at least a 660 credit score. We spend a lot of time executing and working on our home buyer education classes. Last year, we educated more than 3,000 students. We have virtual classes that are live. We have in-person classes that basically occur on a quarterly basis and on-demand courses, which work for well for borrowers who are in a time crunch. We do have Spanish courses, which are both live and on-demand. And that's it for me. Thank you.
Any questions to Peter before we move on to lessons?
Sure. That's great, Peter. Should we paying the how much are we paying the the mortgage brokers, and how does that compare nationally?
So we have two ways to pay our partners. Mortgage brokers pick a rate that they want to get paid, so it's a percentage. Usually it's between 1.5% of the loan amount to 2.5%. Say the average is about 2%. On the correspondent lending side, they get paid what's called a service release premium. And that is both for the servicing rights and the asset, the underlying asset. And I think our average is probably around 2 3/8, 2 1/4 that we pay the lenders.
Probably 2 1/4. And that, as Peter said, it encompasses like an origination fee and the service release premium.
Right. And how does that compare with across the country? Are we high? Are we low? Are we right in the middle?
I would say we're a little higher than the average, but close to the average. For what it's worth, we tend to see nationally that the states in the Northeast pay their lenders a little more than the rest of the country, for what it's worth.
It's now time, given the scarcity of home buying out there, to reduce the amount that you're paying?
Well, this is Kara. I mean, we want to balance that with still receiving loans from our lenders. So if you ask our lenders, we're not paying enough.
Well,
right. Which, that's part of their business.
Right.
I think that if we start reducing some of that service release premium, we will see a reduction in our volume. We want them to continue to help serve this population, which
is not their natural inclination. They're going to want to serve people who have a stronger financial background. And so I think our fees are incentivizing them to do that.
Right, but should we be toggling that given the market? If the market, if it's a gangbuster market, they could make a loan to just about anybody because, you know, everybody's buying a house versus maybe at a time like this when there's not a lot of home buying activity, maybe we can reduce what we pay.
We do adjust it based on the market. So we're doing price adjustments every day on the conventional loans, and on the bond loans, we base it on what our cost of funds are. So we adjust that service release premium based on, you know, what our financing costs are.
To Kara's point, as you can imagine, these loans, these loan officers spend a lot more number of hours with these consumers and our customers than they do with your typical John Rhode Island housing. So their hourly rate is definitely lower with our customer. So, and they add value, the good ones, of course, too.
Sure.
So we're at times, what we see, we're happy and we think they deserve the SRP that they receive.
Sure. And so I was just going to say, so is there any explanation, broadly speaking, for this, the difference between New England and the rest of the country? Are we serving different people?
So Rhode Island, for example, and less so in the other New England states, we're very, very highly concentrated in the FHA market, even compared to Massachusetts, for example. I have much more leverage and much more government-insured lending, generally. And generally, from a secondary marketing perspective, FHA, all things being equal, it's probably a little more generous to what they would pay us. So
they're also more difficult to close, given their regulations to close and to service that, you know, we've seen that a conventional loan, and that's why they, you know, ask for a premium on those loans.
On the homebuyer education, what exactly is on demand?
So that's an online program that a borrower can log in at 3 a.m. to take the class.
Yeah. And stupid question, but how do we know how much they're paying attention at 3 a.m?
They have to answer.
We've got high foreclosure rates. Yeah. It's bucks.
Well, they have to answer questions. Yeah, they're periodic quiz questions throughout the that produce, of course, a certificate.
How does this compare to what I had on by the class requirements?
So out of the options, of course, the quickest, quote unquote, is that on-demand course. And that's the opposite of a HUD course, approved course, which could take 6 to 8 hours in person, live, several sessions. The in-person class is about a 2.5 hour in-person class that we host. And the live virtual class is about a 2 hour course with our instructors, with our underwriting team. And that we also have safeguards and indicators that the student is paying attention and is active and that the keyboard is not staying stagnant for 2 hours.
But HUD requires what? What's a HUD approved required program?
I'm sorry?
What's this, the HUD approved?
The HUD approved is not, we don't offer the HUD approved. We're more than happy for our borrowers to go to the HUD approved course and we encourage it. That's in person. Again, it's probably 6 to 8 hours if you do the full course.
Jumping ahead a little bit, but maybe you'll have this, but I would be interested in knowing in the folks that are in trouble, which it needs to be, we can take how many they took the HUD. See if we can track that data. I'm not sure. Okay, so moving into the default servicing piece, this first line provides data on current makeup of our single family portfolio. As you can see, it's heavily weighted in government insured loans, primarily FHA, and as Kara and Peter alluded to, that's the majority of what we are originating now, and it definitely is a higher touch loan to service. This next slide provides two thoughts. In the first chart, we're looking at our overall delinquency from month end 12/31 of 25.
And our delinquency percentage was 14.89%, which is probably one of the highest percentages that we've seen since the beginning of COVID. The last column of that slide provides an overview of loan performance by year of origination. So the highest level of delinquent loans were originated from 2021 to 2023. And at the end of the presentation, there's an article from the Urban Institute, and you will see in that article that they are also seeing nationally similar performance, particularly in the loans originated in 2022 and 2023. You know, we look at that, we think potentially the spike in delinquency really is reflective of the impacts of COVID and the rising cost of housing that we started seeing during the beginning of COVID, particularly 2021, 2022, 2023. Since then, you know, prices have leveled fairly. And so we're seeing a better performance in the loans originated in 2024 and 2025. At the bottom of this slide, the chart regarding redefaults, I think is a really significant and powerful piece of information. It reflects borrowers have redefaulted who have received at least one COVID loss mitigation option. So of the 2,108 delinquent borrowers from month end December, 1,266 of those borrowers are borrowers who previously received loss mitigation. And I, you know, mentioned that they previously received at least one form of loss mitigation. Most of our borrowers have received two or more. And we have some borrowers that have received loss mitigation up to seven times since the COVID options were introduced in 2020. So when you look at the performance of our portfolio in the 14.89%, that percentage would be significantly less had these loss mitigation options been successful and borrowers have been able to sustain payments under those options. So one of the key factors involved in underwriting is debt to income ratio. Peter touched upon that in one of his slides. So this data shows us the performance based upon debt to income ratio. So Peter talked about housing ratio and then the total ratio. So historically in underwriting, there used to be two ratios. There was a housing ratio and there was the total debt ratio. So the housing ratio is the mortgage payment divided by gross income. And that really speaks to whether or not that mortgage payment is affordable. The total ratio, which the industry has fully moved to now, is the mortgage payment divided into the mortgage payment plus all of your other debt, your credit cards, your student loans, your auto payments, divided into your gross monthly income. So I provided both because we like to look at trying to determine whether or not the housing payment is really what's causing the delinquency, or could it be the other debt that the borrowers have? And we often do see that that other debt is really what is causing margin. We oftentimes see that other debt might not even be the debt that they originally had at time of underwriting, but debt that they obtained after they closed. So when you speak about home buyer education, that's one of the critical pieces of information that needs to be communicated to a first-time home buyer. You know, don't take advantage of all of these solicitations that you receive after you close, you know, because those payments obviously will cause, you know, financial stress. So when looking at this chart, the higher the debt-to-income ratio, the higher the delinquency. So, I mean, I think it pretty much speaks to what we expect. The highest level of delinquency are above borrowers at 45 DTI and higher.
That's not that much.
It actually gets lower if you go above 40.
For the housing, it does.
Yeah.
The housing it does. For the total ratio, it's the higher DTIs.
Are you able to think about why this 35 to 40 crowd spikes? It's minor, but it doesn't seem logical.
Well, the only thing I can say is what I just mentioned, right?
Except the other stuff.
Right. So these are the ratios at the time of underwriting. But did these borrowers obtain significant, you know, debt after closing?
Yeah.
Okay. Buy the furniture, you know, it definitely helps the borrower's credit score, having a mortgage payment on their credit boosts their credit score and makes them more attractive to other creditors who are looking for them to get credit cards or buy furniture, or, you know, whatever, large screen TV, whatever it may be, you know. Second factor in underwriting is the FICO score, is the credit score. So obviously, borrowers below 620 are performing the worst at a 34% delinquency ratio, and borrowers over 700 at a 6% ratio. So I think this really is what we would have expected. Peter mentioned the overlay of a minimum 620 FICO. We implemented that in 2018, so that's why you're going to see here in this data, FICO's below 620. If it was loans originated maybe mid-2018 forward, where we implemented the 620 FICO. And then the minimum 660 FICO for first mortgages with non-amortizing down payment assistance loans. Next slide looks at the income of the households and how that may be affecting delinquency performance. So the highest level of delinquency is for borrowers between $51,000 and $75,000 in income. And the strongest performers are borrowers making $126,000 and more. We also pull data around whether we have a single borrower or we have two or more borrowers. Not that much difference, surprisingly, between the performance of a single borrower or two or more borrowers. So this slide, I think, is probably the most powerful slide. And it shows the impact of the rising cost of housing on the ability for a first-time home buyer to make payments. So this heat map shows the average delinquent loan payment by loan origination year. So for example, in 2019, for loans originated in 2019, the average delinquent loan payment is $1,872, and the average delinquent loan balance is $226,000. Jump forward to 2025, the average delinquent loan payment is $3,500, and the average delinquent loan balance is nearly $434,000. So I think, you know, this speaks to, as the cost of housing increased, and we'll look at some statistics on the next page, but as the cost of housing increased, obviously the payments increased significantly. It's a lot harder when you fall behind to come up with, you know, two payments of $3,500 than it is to come up with two payments of $1,872. So what are some of the factors impacting increased delinquency? And I'm speaking specifically to FHA because that's 72% of our portfolio. And an FHA borrower is a riskier borrower, higher debt to income than what Fannie and Freddie will allow. And even though we've implemented the FICO of 620 for a minimum, FHA would allow a FICO in the 500s. So the credit profile of that borrower is clearly different. And I think those borrowers are the most impacted, particularly by inflation, the rising costs of essential expenses, health insurance, utilities, food, real estate taxes, insurance. And also, those borrowers probably have the lowest incomes when we looked at the income chart, and the borrowers who are performing the strongest are those with the higher incomes. Typically, that is not the FHA borrower. So the greatest impact, inflation has the greatest impact on the lowest income households. FHA has also recently made significant changes in their loss mitigation practices. And I think I've spoken to this a couple of different times. But as of October 1st, they eliminated the COVID loss mitigation guidelines. They ended those policies and they made some significant changes. So one change is a borrower has to make at least 4 payments before they can be eligible for loss mitigation. So if we have a new homeowner who closes and they have an emergency, you know, they become ill and they're out of work, we can offer them forbearance, but we can't offer them a permanent loss mitigation solution until they make at least 4 consecutive payments. So that does cause limitations for borrowers who have financial difficulty. Also, borrowers who receive a permanent loss mitigation option after October 1st cannot receive another one for 24 months. So I mentioned that we've had some borrowers during, you know, the 6 years since COVID who have come back pretty much annually and asked for assistance. That will no longer be an option. We have to have 24 months between loss mitigation options. So we most likely will see impacts of that change. And the other significant change is FHA resumed requiring that borrowers make what is called a trial payment plan. So they have to show for at least a period of 3 months their ability to make that modified payment. So they've been delinquent. They may not have made payments for 2, 3, 4 months. During COVID, we could just, if they attested to the fact that they could afford the new payment, we could implement that payment immediately. Now they have to show us through a trial payment that they can afford that new payment. So that actually has really had an impact on our rising delinquency. So when we talk about that 14.89%, that spike over the last few months, much of that has been attributed to the fact that as borrowers enter a trial payment plan, they're going to roll maybe from 90 days to 120 to 150 to 180. So if you look at our delinquency, you're going to see that 90 plus day delinquency category growing significantly, where before we were seeing that that category being reduced as borrowers entered into loss mitigation and we reinstated their loan. So that, you know, will roll. However, I think over time we will see that go back down to more reasonable levels. And then the last item I have here is really related to that heat map, which was the last slide that I showed, increasing cost of housing, the purchase prices, and the payment shock. So when we compared 2019's average monthly payment to 2025, that's an actual increase of 87%. So over that 6-year period, the average payment has increased 87%, and the reality is that wages have not increased 87% over that period of time. Same thing with the average principal balance of a delinquent loan, 2019 to 2025. We feel that definitely is a factor in what we're seeing in rising delinquencies within our portfolio. And then the last slide, there is a link here to an article by the Urban Institute. So within the industry, our colleagues, we participate bi-monthly in user groups with the National Council State Housing Agencies. They sponsor those user groups, and we participate with other HFAs that are servicing their loans as well as those that are not servicing. We share a lot of information, talk about some of our challenges, what different states are seeing in terms of the performance of their portfolio. And I will say that pretty much this is a national issue. It's not unique to Rhode Island Housing's portfolio. Clearly in the Northeast, I think we're seeing more of an impact. I think housing prices, you know, the two coasts, the Northeast, the West Coast, the East Coast, more so than the Midwestern states. We definitely have been impacted significantly more with housing price increases. But many of us, talk about what we think the issues are. Is the DTI, did FHA stretch that DTI too high? Does it make sense that it's over 50%? And is that really one of the factors that's impacting this? Are they too low on their FICO scores? So these questions are questions that are being asked on a national basis. And this Urban Institute article actually speaks to what they consider several commonly identified possible reasons for the increases in FHA delinquency. Is it relaxed origination standards, particularly the debt-to-income ratio? Is it constitutional from the GSEs that are pushing a greater number of riskier borrowers to FHA products? Is it the lack of, when they talk about the lack of home price appreciation, particularly in loans that have been originated within the last couple of years? Is it loss mitigation that has encouraged borrowers not to make the payments, allowed them to come back 7 times in 6 years to ask for assistance? Or is it the credit scores being indicative, allowing credit scores below what we have at 620? So I'll let you read the article yourself, but pretty much a number of these factors were debunked within that article. And so the experts within, you know, the Urban Institute, the people who researched the data, do not agree that those are the primary reasons that we're seeing increased delinquency. But I'll let you look at that and see what you think about it. Do we stay the course or do we consider making changes in our underwriting? I think it's really a balance. For those, we have, you know, a delinquency rate of nearly 15%. So that means we have 85% of our portfolio performing. And 85% of that portfolio may be people who have debt-to-income ratios above 50% and have FICOs that are, you know, below 75. So those borrowers are performing. So do we make decisions that could eliminate opportunities for those borrowers to be first-time home buyers? It really has to do with what type of an appetite we have for risk and what we think is a reasonable delinquency rate for our portfolio.
Thank you. One thing to add, I think one advantage we have is the team at Loan Servicing and the folks that are so experienced in this business and their ability to work with homeowners, I mean, even given the limited tools that they have. But, you know, a lot of places you cannot pick up the phone and talk with someone about what you're experiencing. We have that advantage here, not only with Loan Center, but certainly with Lessons Group.
Thank you.
Oh, Kevin.
Commissioner, worth the question. I think it would be very helpful to show the comparison of the building fund loan amount versus the value of the home. So we can see, you know, who's underwater, or what percentage of these delinquent borrowers are really underwater, how much we might be facing, I guess, loss there.
We can do that. We can do it based upon the purchase price of the original appraised value. I think that probably loans originated in the last, say, 3 years are not necessarily underwater, but they may be underwater with when you take their principal balance plus their arrearage, if they've received assistance from FHA in a partial claim, or that's been deferred to the end of under the loan. Obviously, that increases their overall debt. If they did a loss mitigation where we capitalized arrearage, so we added to the principal balance. So I don't think people are underwater based upon their original purchase price.
Yeah, that's the total amount relative to the current value of the home. If I know that's going to be an approximate, we're not going to send out our appraisal to do all these, you know.
What I would say is with the FHA loans, we're 100% insured on our principal balance. We get the majority of our interest. They disallow about 60 days of interest, which they refer to as debenture interest. And we get the majority of our advances. We get our escrow advances in full and get the majority of our legal expenses. So from a risk perspective, a financial risk perspective to the agency, I don't think there's a lot of risk since we have 72% of our portfolio with FHA insured loans. The risk is more to the homeowner in losing them. But we definitely can get that same.
And we didn't always look that way, right? We had a higher percentage of
right. So when you look at the first slide here, that other category, so we've got 17.3% conventional, 73.5% government insured, and then 9.2%. That 9.2% is that other. They were MRB loans with private mortgage insurance or loans that are uninsured. Those are mostly the season loans within our portfolio. you. We're still on enterprise licenses. Who's covering this, Brett?
I am. It's the reason you're all here today is to talk about a Microsoft license. I'm Madam Chair and the rest of the committee. I'm here to ask for your approval of a 3-year extension to our Microsoft Enterprise agreement for the agency, Dell Marketing LP, which is the state's preferred vendor for Microsoft reseller licenses. This covers all of our tech stack here, really our licenses for Microsoft Office 365 and Copilot and our servers and our Azure stack and our backups, hosting all sorts of things. It's a 3-year contract. The initial first year pricing, $213,970.69, which is trued up at the end of every year based on actual usage. We bring on more employees or we reduce our data needs or whatever, we have to pay a per-person received license every year. So that gets trued up at the end of every year. Happy to answer any questions. It's fairly self-explanatory.
Do I have a motion?
Approve, this is Steve.
Second. Any questions or comments? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
That was unanimous. Thank you. Approval of the engagement of a consultant for 2026 continuum of care program competition. Elizabeth.
Yes, thank you. This is Elizabeth Pioto. This request for action is for approval to engage Housing Innovations to develop an application or multiple applications for FY26 continuum of care funding. As you are aware, the continuum of care is a grant program of the Department of Housing and Urban Development and the Rhode Island Continuum of Care has a portfolio of just over $17 million annually in HUD funding at this time, and those grants fund supportive housing, different aspects of the homeless response system, and their service programs throughout the state. As we've discussed before, that funding is awarded competitively every year, which means we have to regularly reapply for renewal funding or compete nationally for new funding. As the designated collaborative applicant, Rhode Island Housing is the only entity eligible to submit those applications to HUD on behalf of the statewide continuum of care. And we've routinely utilized consultant expertise to help strengthen those applications because they are complicated and involve large local competitions that we have to host statewide for a number of entities. So towards that goal for next year, we have issued an RFP seeking a qualified firm to support us with that consultation. We issued it in October, and we received 4 proposals from qualified firms. There's some additional information on the matrix that Marlene just circulated about the proposals. So a committee of Rhode Island Housing staff from the executive division reviewed the proposals in accordance with the criteria and support them, and we are recommending approval of Housing Innovation based on their strong project approach, their proven ability to do this work in concert with us in years past, and their reasonable fee structure. So if you approve, we'll start our work on the 2026 funding competition in April and contract with them before April. To begin, the exact deadlines of the competition are unknown, but we anticipate at least the major competition to have a deadline in fall of 2026. So this timeline sets us up perfectly for that. And the training elements of the scope of work in our RFP will happen after the competition's closed, and this firm will be positioned to support us with those through March of 2027. It is quite likely HUD will issue more than one competition this year. And so the proposal we received is the contract will issue will scale up to the total 40,000 that we're recommending for the engagement, depending on if multiple competitions come in. Happy to answer any other questions if you have.
Have a motion.
Motion to approve, this is Steve.
Second, Kev Hort.
Questions or comments? I know there's not a clean answer to this, but I'll take the opportunity to ask, where are we with COC, the courts?
Yes. Okay. we are still in limbo. But I spoke with you all, I think it was 2 months ago, perhaps, and there have been some developments since then. And perhaps Amy can help me with this, but the T-HUD bill that just passed does give us some clarity on the fiscal year 25 contracts, which are the ones involved in the litigation. So this is what we're discussing today formally is about next year. Uh-huh. So we're prepared for them. But for this year, the T-HUD bill sets trigger dates for automatic renewal of the competition. And so, of the contracts. And so one contract in Rhode Island has already, its trigger date has already triggered. And so they'll get a renewal contract because they were in the first quarter of the year. Second quarter grant, I believe it's April 1st. If there's no decision out of HUD by then, will trigger. And then the rest of our portfolio, all of the remaining grants would trigger if there's no decision on litigation or by HUD in July 1st. That sounds a little bit far away, but with how long the competition takes from issuance to awards, which is what the trigger date is in the legislation, it's quite unlikely that HUD will be able to do what they need to do by July 1st. I think, and Corey, please chime in if you have anything more to add, but I think with the litigation, they're in conversation with HUD right now about what the legislation means for the fiscal year 25 competition and how that might impact the future. So expect to know more later this month.
And if I could add one thing, this is Corey Meyer speaking. Elizabeth, on behalf of the COC, RA Housing has now indicated intent to renew all grants within the Rhode Island COC that are eligible for renewal to take advantage of the most favorable renewal terms rather than to subject the equivalent funds to competition.
It's not much of an answer.
All in favor of approval of the engagement?
Aye.
That was unanimous. Thank you. Is that any other business? Seeing none, do I have a motion to adjourn?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Meeting of the commissioners has adjourned. We now have a turn to the meeting for the questions of the Affordable Housing Trust. Yes.
Stop this recording. Yeah. Terry, will you stop the recording and then open it back up for us?